podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Welcome to A Celtic State of Mind. I'm Paul John Dykes and we continue today with our daily Axon podcasts. Day 15, podcast number 15, and I'm going to be looking back at the centenary season and in particular Neely Mochan. Back in 2015, you may be aware that I wrote Neely Mochan's biography, Celtic Smiler. On the back of that, there was a documentary adaptation which I was one of the producers of. That gave me the opportunity to speak to a lot of ex-Celtic players who had experience of working alongside or under Neely Mochan, as well as a lot of Neely's family members. It was a great experience, and you can actually still watch that documentary on Amazon Prime, and for a limited period of time, you can watch it on YouTube. We've managed to put it up on YouTube during these times where people are isolated and may wish to watch some Celtic history in the comfort of their own home. The book itself became a hugely rare Celtic book. It was quite unusual for a modern Celtic book to become rare so quickly. And it has become a very sought-after biography, which unfortunately on Amazon has changed hands for astronomical amounts. A Celtic State of Mind will put that right in the coming months because we will republish that book as a paperback. And there will be a lot more content within the book, including new interviews that I have conducted since the release of the 2015 first edition. I've also got a foreword by John Clark, the Lisbon Lion, who someday hopefully will write his own book. Version 2 of that book, which is about 30,000 words more than the original, is now available as a PDF. All you need to do is get in touch on my Twitter page and tell me that you wish a copy of that book and I'll email it out to you. When we finally get round to publishing the updated version, it will be fully updated from the PDF version, so you're getting an unreleased version of that particular book. One thing I quickly realised when I was writing books is that the interviews you actually do for them are more or less put in a vault and never seen again. One or two paragraphs or anecdotes from the interviews make it into the book. The rest of the material, which is highly intriguing and amusing, lies in a vault, never to be heard again. And that actually was one of the reasons for starting a podcast, to get the full interviews with these figures out there for Celtic fans to enjoy. There are quite a few of the interviews that I did for the Neely Mochan documentary, which I'm going to tap into for a series of podcasts on Neely. The first one is focusing on that memorable centenary season, and I'll be speaking to Celtic striker Andy Walker, who we bought from Motherwell that year and who went on to be our top goal scorer. He enjoyed two spells at the club and got to know Neely Mochan very well. What are your memories of joining Celtic in 1987, and what was Neely's role at that point?
I've got fabulous memories of coming to Celtic. It was July 87, and I'd pretty much been tapped up with Celtic because my old man had been in contact with one of the directors, Jim Farrell, and I was at Motherwell at the time, and he'd approached my old man around February, would your son be interested in coming to Celtic? And my dad didn't tell me until we were knocked out of the Scottish Cup. We had a pretty decent year that year at Motherwell, and we got knocked out, I think, in the quarterfinals with Dundee United. And then my old man said, told me that Celtic were going to come and get you in the summer. And I played the last few months at Motherwell with just a huge smile on my face, because the prospect of going and signing for Celtic was just fabulous. And yeah, I've got to say, I was a bit starstruck, because when I went into a new dressing room at Celtic, Celtic are my team. I'm one of 11 children. There's 7 boys in our house, and my old man took us to games since I was 5-6 years old. So some of our best memories as a family are, you know, jumping over the gate and going to see Celtic in big games against Rangers, big games in Europe, semi-finals at Hampden, cup finals at Hampden. My childhood memories are full of all that. In fact, Big Billy's last game, 75 Cup final against Airdrie. It was one of the first big games I was at. I was only 10 years old. So my whole childhood was dominated by fabulous Celtic memories. So to go into a dressing room where not only was Big Billy the manager, but I was pretty much playing alongside some of my heroes, Paul McStay, who was the same age as me, but I'd been watching him play for Celtic for 2-3 years, Roy Aitken, Pat Bonner, Tommy Burns, some fabulous names that have been at Celtic for so long and had played in successful teams, and that was all I was interested in. I just wanted to be part of the team and part of a team that had success. And I know Billy took me aside when he signed me and he said, look, I'm not going to make a big splash about you signing. I think they paid about 350, 400 grand. And he said, look, Davy Proven is retiring, so we're going to announce that. And I'm also going to announce the signing of Billy Stark. And that should take the pressure off you, and that'll bring you in. And I remember it as if it was yesterday, because it was fabulous. So I'd 3 years at Motherwell, and actually I was getting married that year. So my wife was really happy because I signed for Celtic. We got married shortly after that, and we had a honeymoon. Well, we didn't really have a honeymoon. We had 2 days up at Glen Eagles, and then I went for 10 days to Sweden with Celtic. So great days, really great days, and just what was awaiting you, how were you going to fit in, where are you going to fit in, and how is the team going to do, because Rangers were spending a lot of money, they had a really good side, Big Billy had come back, there were so many changes, we'd lost Murdo McLeod and Alan McInally, David Proven had retired, Brian McClair had moved on to Man United, there was a lot of changes, so, but I was in the same boat with Billy Stark, Chris Morris, who was a new player, Mick McCarthy. And but we were made to feel really welcome, of course. Great great setup, great boys, training was terrific, and really enjoyed the pre-season.
Now, Neely Mockin was in charge of the kit. Could you tell me what the process of trying to obtain a pair of football boots was like around about that time?
Well, that was my first experience of meeting Neely Mockin, who, of course, everyone who was a Celtic fan knew Neely and his history, and you know the goals that he scored and that fabulous left foot of his. And when I first came up to the ground, I pretty much came up with nothing. I went in very early because I didn't want to be late in any way. So I went down to the ground. We had to be in for about 10 o'clock. I was there for about 8:45, and there was no one in. And Neely Mockin came into the dressing room and, how you doing? A bit of chat. And we were going up to Strathclyde Park for training. He told me that. I was braced for all that. And all I had was training shoes. And I asked him if it'd be okay if I could get a pair of football boots. And he said, bits? You want a new pair of bits? New bits, son. You're only on the door 2 minutes. And I thought, geez, what's he talking about? This is kit, man. Give us a pair of boots. And I remember the dressing room at Celtic, which I hadn't been in before, of course, but there was this huge storage space at the back, and Neely went up and opened it. You could see all this stuff that was in there. I think he kept absolutely everything, strips, boots, gear. And this was July 87 I signed for Celtic, and he gave me a brand new pair of Adidas World Cup 82 boots that was in the stitching. They were brilliant boots, and I used them in pre-season. We went to Sweden. We played 3-4 games over there, and the boots were fabulous. But I always remember Neely saying that, bits, a new pair. You're in the door 2 minutes, son. You want a new pair of bits? What have we got here? And that was Neely, and that was his style, and he was great.
Going into your first pre-season in 1987, was Neely Mockin able to assist you or guide you in any way to make an impression on your teammates and the management staff?
Yeah, I went over and really keen to make an impact. We went to Sweden, played a couple of amateur sides, and I was struggling to make a bit of an impact. I think I played about three games and hadn't scored. But I remember the first game because I didn't play well. And I know it was a centenary year, but we weren't wearing the centenary strips. We were wearing the old C.R. Smith, just with the Celtic crest. And I think Neely saw I was a wee bit despondent, a wee bit too keen to try and impress. And he came up to me quietly afterwards and said, "You keep that jersey, son. That's your first." And I gave it to my brother, which I think he still has. I hope he still has. But it was a nice touch from Neely. And he tended to do some lovely things with various players. I mean, he wasn't all this great, you know, gruff voice that you would hear and, you know, taking the mickey out of everyone and laughing at some of your attempts at, you know, trying to score a goal or winning big games, because he could always come back at you with fabulous tales of some of the teams that he played in and some of the goals that he scored.
Now, that centenary side had a magnificent spirit. How big a part did Billy McNeil's backroom team play in that?
Well, it was the backroom staff played a huge part, in my view, because any time when we went to play a big game, we'd go down to Seamill to prepare for a European game, semi-final or final, and you'd always have Neely Mochan there. He'd always be sitting with Billy McNeil, Tommy Craig, and, of course, Jimmy Steele, who was a fabulous guy to have around your squad of whatever it was, 15, 16 players. He would bounce off everyone. His patter was magnificent. He would keep everyone at ease. He'd be chatting up the youngest girls who were, you know, serving us our dinner, just having a laugh with them all and making us feel so comfortable. And I loved those days, going down to Seamill. I always thought it was a great pity when Liam Brady came into the club, and he just didn't like it. He didn't like it. He felt as though Seamill wasn't plush enough. It was too far away from Glasgow. But it was a fabulous setup, and I loved going to Seamill, because if you're going to Seamill, you're going to prepare for a big game, and we always had these tremendous games on the grass just in front of the hotel, and losers into the sea, which was always made it really competitive. And invariably it was, we always, I think we tended to play the married men against the single men, and of course I was one of the young ones and I'd just get married, so that was great. I was in with Roy Aitken, Tommy Burns, and I think we won more than we lost, so it was always a good laugh.
Neely Mochan had seen and done it all in a Celtic jersey. How important was he in the lead-up to the big games and these semi-finals and finals at Hampden?
I don't remember him coming round and, you know, Neely saying anything to me individually, but I do remember seeing him and, you know, having a quiet word. I think it was more or less the experienced players, and we had big experience, Pat Bonner, Roy Aitken, Tommy Burns. I remember Neely being around them. He always tended to be doing something with their boots, changing their studs or whatever. And he was always in and around the dressing room. He was always in and around Big Billy. So when Big Billy did all of his work and addressed us as a group, sometimes Billy would come over and address me and Frank as a partnership. If Joe was playing, you know, the three of us up front, he would address the three of us together. But he would always retreat into the back corner, and it was always Billy, Tommy Craig, Neely was there, and Steely as well. Sometimes he'd give Steely a nudge, get up and give them a bit of your chat, and he'd go through his spiel. And Neely was quietly going round, just doing his own thing. He wasn't one for a, you know, making any sort of grand speeches. He was always quiet. He was always in the corner. He was always saying, just quietly spoken. And it was a real contrast to that sort of, when you approached him in front of people and he had this sort of gruff manner and would always slap you down, but with a bit of humour in it, which was typical on Ely. And no, these guys were a huge part of what was a really successful season. And of course, we all know the type of legacy that guys like Billy McNeil have got with his European Cup winning exploits, but Neely in the Coronation Cup and playing against Rangers, beating them 7-1, scoring all these goals, and that left foot of his that he didn't bring it up all the time, but once or twice when he brought it up, Grant, he was always the one who would, you know, tease a wee story out of him, and he could get into him. And while he was watching the racing, maybe if we're having a plate of soup a few hours before kick off in a pre-match, Grant would be the one that would get a good story out of Neely. And they had a fabulous relationship. I think they were particularly close.
Neely was famous for keeping players' feet on the ground, and none more so with yourself at half time during a game against Dundee where you'd scored a couple of goals and you were 3-0 up.
Well, it's my favourite story about Neely, and just summed him up to a T. And I was so keen to make an impression early on and be part of a successful team and just look as though I deserve to be here, because my first game at Celtic Park hadn't gone well. We'd been hammered by Arsenal 5-1. A lot of new players in the team. I think all the supporters were wondering, what are we going to get here? We didn't play well. But the season did start well for the club and for me. I was scoring goals on a regular basis. I think round about October, November, we played Dundee at Celtic Park, and Jim Duffy was playing for Dundee. I thought, class player, Jim. And I'd made a really good start to the game. I'd scored two goals in the first 10 minutes. We came in at half time. We were 3-0 up. It was a horrible day. Howling wind and rain. And being up against Jim Duffy, I remember chasing a ball into the corner, just down the far side, over the jungle side, and he just gave us a bump, gave us an elbow, and he sent me flying onto the track. So I was covered head to toe in this ash. I was wet, I was soaked to the skin. And I remember the half-time whistle going, thunderous applause. We're 3-0 up, we're playing well. And get into the dressing room and over to see Neely, and I'd take my strip off. I said, "Neely, any chance of getting a new strip? This is manky, it's soaking, and any chance of a new strip for the second half?" "A new strip, son? No, you're not playing well enough." And the daft thing was, he was right. I'd scored two goals, but my game was about, you know, a good touch, bringing others into play, linking up. And I hadn't been playing well. Touch was awful. I'd scored two goals, lucky enough to do that. But Neely was right. I hadn't played well. And you just accepted it. Aye, you're right. So I went back into the dressing room. I'm wringing out my strip. I'm trying to sweep off all these ash from the strip, putting it on the radiator. Even my shorts are soaking. You don't get a change of anything. Back out for the second half of this soaking strip on the second half that's really manky, full of red blaze, and it was fine. We won 5-0, and I think it might have been Joe Miller's debut, and Joe scored, played really well. I get two, I'm sure Frank scored as well, but it was a right good team performance. I think I played better in the second half and I didn't score, but that was Neely. Not a chance you were getting a new strip because you only played well enough.
After Billy McNeil departed, how did Neely's role change under Liam Brady?
My recollection of the changes was, it certainly didn't work out for me, Liam Brady coming in and taking over from Billy McNeil. And, you know, that was fine. I think when I look back, I signed a four-year contract and I'd stayed there for 4 years. I think looking back, I was pretty much a regular for the first couple, played every week. The last couple, you know, Billy was changing it. We were still chasing Rangers, and Jack Janowski came in, Tommy Coyne came in, John Hewitt came in at various stages. When Liam eventually took over from Billy, he told me immediately I wasn't part of his plans, which was absolutely fine. I'd had 4 years, 4 years more than I thought I would get at Celtic, and I was happy to move on. There was no gripe on my part, but I seem to remember in those early games when Liam was trying to make a bit of an impact. I don't think Neely was as close to Liam. Liam certainly didn't want to be close to Neely. He wanted his own team in there. He brought in Mick Martin. There was other guys around him. And I think Neely was a wee bit on the periphery of things, and just a different feel to the club. Billy is in the fabric. Billy McNeil's in the fabric of Celtic and their history, and no one would ever, you know, question his place. Liam had come in a bit like Graeme Souness, totally new, totally fresh, no management experience whatsoever, and it was taking him a bit of a while to come, I think, to come to grips with the size of the club, how to deal with not just a match day, but just being a Celtic manager every day in life. And I thought Billy was great at handling the press. He could tell them one thing, and he would actually say to us in the dressing room, "Listen, I'm going to tell a few of the press boys this. Don't believe a word of it. It's just for them." And I can remember feeling 10 feet tall under Billy McNeil, because my first Old Firm experience, when Billy Stark scored the winner 1-0 at Celtic Park, I can remember coming in at half time being as high as a kite. We were 1-0 up, and Billy was just laughing. I'm looking over at Neely, who was standing beside him, and he's looking at Neely and he's saying, "They're playing some of the best football I've ever seen in an Old Firm game. I mean, better than anything we could come up with." I mean, when I think of it now, not a chance were we playing as well as any of the, you know, Lisbon Lions or whatever. I mean, those guys stand alone. But Billy was saying this to us, a new team, new players, and he's bouncing it off Neely, and it's coming back to us, and we are just feeling 10 feet tall. We're going out into the second half, we play even better. We get this 1-0 victory, Graeme Souness gets sent off, there's a tremendous atmosphere, there's this big bust up in the tunnel after the game, where when I came in the tunnel, I saw Billy and Neely outside the dressing room, and Souness was having a go at them, and he's giving them a bit of stick about, you know his Man City and Villa days, and Billy's giving it back, and I think Neely wanted to get in front of him. Billy's holding Neely back, and it was just a fabulous experience for someone in their first Old Firm game. And I think Billy had the ability to make you feel 10 feet tall. I don't really have a relationship with Liam. We never had that experience where we were all winning big games, really. So maybe he could have made you feel 10 feet tall, but not in a way where Big Billy could. So I was happy to move on, and I don't think there was that same closeness with Neely towards Liam as there was with Billy, obviously.
You've mentioned being in and out of the side, Andy, during your final two seasons under Billy McNeil. Were you ever party to Neely giving Billy advice in the dugout?
I do. I remember having a fallout with Billy where he'd taken me off. I think it was against Dundee United, and we lost the game 1-0, and I was getting the hump because I felt as though he'd been taking me off far too much in recent weeks, and I said to him, "Is that the only number you've got there, number 10? Is that the only number you hold on when you want to make a change?" And it wasn't Billy who turned round and gave me a blast. It was Neely. "You shut up, son. Sit back there and just watch the rest of the game." So there was about half an hour to go, and whatever else happened. And Frank was our top man at the time, Frank McAvenny, best striker I ever played with, and he missed a chance, and I'm looking at Neely. "Oh, Billy, get him off as well." And this was in the midst of a game, and, you know, Billy's throwing somebody to the ground, and, you know, Neely's winding him up to say, "Oh, get him off." I always remember the story Frank tells me about the time he he'd scored four goals against Morton at Capello, and nearly saying, hey, get him off, because he didn't want him to get the five goals that Neely had scored in his time. I don't think Frank had taken off. I think he says he did, but I don't think Billy took him off. This was all part of Billy's management style. There were the dugouts, if you remember, at Celtic Park, very low. You sat down, no one was standing except when you came out of the tunnel, and it was always Billy, Tommy and Neely, and they were always in the front. I think sometimes Steely might have been in the front once or twice, or he was in at the back with the, and it was just the two subs, of course. So it wasn't this team of sports scientists and masseurs and doctors and five subs now that you get enormous area, the technical area now. It's not even a dugout anymore. But Neely was very much part of it, and I'm sure, having spoken to Billy numerous times over the years, he did look once or twice over to Neely for a spot of advice. Sometimes he'd get a bit of humour, and of course he had a close relationship with Tommy Craig, but there were times when I'm sure Neely would give him a wee nugget of information.
And when you left Celtic, when you finally left Celtic, were there any words of advice from Neely, who had made that move himself down south back in the 1950s?
No, there was no real farewell. I remember my departure from Celtic was, I wouldn't say it was sour in any way. I knew I was leaving. There was a daft story about, you know, Liam Brady, who was actually, when he came into the club, he said, look, Andy, you're not going to be part of my team, and, you know, if you can get yourself a club, you'll move on, and that'll be it. And I think when I left, players weren't moving as freely as they once were. A lot of clubs were spending money on their ground. The Taylor Port had come in after the Hillsborough stuff. They were still spending money on doing up their ground, and there was an offer for me to go back to Motherwell, to Tommy McLean. I didn't want to go back to Motherwell. There was another offer in from Falkirk under Jim Jeffries. I think it was about 150 grand. Didn't want to go. I just wanted to go to England. I just wanted to go down south. Wanted something new. And I knocked back Falkirk. And Liam wasn't happy. And he pulled me in the next day and he said, if you don't go to Falkirk, I'm going to stop your wages. And I said, Liam, what are you doing this? You're only in the management game 2 minutes and you're already behaving like Jim McLean. I mean, I'm just going to bide my time and go to a club that I want to go at. And around that time, I was training with Liam had asked me to go and train with the reserve sometimes, which was fine because Bobby Lennox was looking after him. Training was really good. A lot of the young boys were great trainers. Lex Bailey, Jerry Craney, Jerry Britton, some good lads there, Stevie Fulton, all trying to knock on the door of the first team. So training was good and I enjoyed it under Bobby, but it was only once or twice at that stage. I didn't leave, I think, until late January, February, and nearly, I remember just taking my side. It was only once, and it was a nothing day. It was a Tuesday afternoon. And he said, just hang in there, Andy, something good will come for you. I know it's not happening just now, but you'll get something. And there was nothing gruff in his voice. There was no humour in it. It was just a moment where, you know, I think he maybe felt as though I was banging my head against a brick wall trying to get away, and nearly saw it. And it was just a nice touch. He was a mixture of everything. Nearly, and when I came back to the club, 94, I came back for a couple of years, and that was when I realised he had leukaemia. And I remember being pre-season, we were over in Dublin, I think, over in Ireland, and I mentioned that I could see Nearly still doing what he was doing after the game, because all the strips, we'd taken our gear off, we'd put it on the dressing room floor, and Neely, of course, was going around and he's picking everything up, and I saw some of the young boys that were there and they were doing nothing, and hey guys, come on, get Neely a hand. And mentioned it to Paul, who was the captain, of course, and Paul gave him a bit of a rocket. And I don't know what we could do. We all knew that Neely was struggling. We all knew that he didn't have the same energy levels. He was sleeping a lot, which wasn't like him. You know, you'd catch him, you know, just falling asleep in a chair, or maybe going through to the, you know, where we used to have our plate of soup, and he might be, you know, just having a wee nap in there. And obviously, he was being drained of all his energy. And it was horrible to see him not have that spark, that level of energy and drive, and, you know, that great face that he had when he was up watching the racing. He loved the horses, and I don't think he ever won. I don't remember ever coming in happy because he'd won a bet. He was always second or third, or it was nowhere to be seen, his horse. But he was great, always great company, always part of, you know, the best memories I have with Celtic as a team, and going with some of your teammates to see Mill, to away grounds, to big games, to Ibrox. Neely was always part of the dressing room and part of your preparation, part of your celebration when you had a right good result. And it was always a hard school sometimes when you lost a game, and it wouldn't happen to us. He played in great teams, and he would always bring you back down to earth if you ever thought about getting ideas above your station. So fabulous Celtic name, fabulous history he had, and just so pleased to have known him for as long as I did.
There's an infamous story which I think originated from Peter Grant, where some of the boys tried to get Neely back with a practical joke. Were you part of that prank?
I think I was injured. I didn't go. I wasn't there. Maybe it's one for Granty to remind Granty of the time where we're all at the table, and I think Neely, it was Granty that sort of put it in front of him. They're waiting in all these steaks. There was this bowl of pepper sauce, and Granty put it in front of him and said, "There's your oxtail soup." So Neely's dipping his bread into this pepper sauce, and it was absolutely roasting. It was on fire. And he was, "Oh, that soup has got a fair kick to it, Granny." And it was Granny that put it in front of him. And you should ask Granny about the time where I think it was the same trip, and again, I wasn't on it. I was injured. And they'd gone down. They were sitting on the beach, and they gave, it was roasted, and give some of that suntan cream, son. And Granny gave him oil. You know, we used to put oil on your skin, just let your skin burn. I mean, unheard of now, but in those days you could put oil on your skin, and Neely's like that. Oh, brilliant. That'll give us some protection. He was sitting, just chatting away for a couple of hours. That night, apparently, they could not stop laughing. Whenever Neely went, his face was just shining. This bright red face, as it was burnt to an absolute crisp. You should ask Granny about that one. They were the best days. Mm-hmm. I was playing with all my heroes, and Neely was just a great Celtic name.
Andy Walker, the only thing left for me to say is thank you for sharing your memories of Neely Mochan and your days at Celtic Park.
Network.